The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Rheumatoid arthritis is presented by Dr. Robert DiGiovanni.
Okay, so the first lecture is going to be on rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. Slides have been prepared by a couple of my fellows. I always say, share the fame, but spread the blame. So if you don't like the slides, okay, but no, I'm just joking. The fellows did an awesome job putting these lectures together, and we're trying to go more to a case format presentation to kind of draw you in, kind of get you thinking about when you should be thinking about rheumatic diseases. When does your patient have rheumatoid arthritis, or how does systemic sclerosis, we just had a patient came in with undiagnosed systemic sclerosis who had pulmonary fibrosis, even on a CAT scan from a couple of years ago. So, you know, when do you start thinking of vasculitis? And that's really what I want you to take away from this. I have no disclosures. I no longer speak or do studies for evil industry. No, I'm only kidding. I like industry. They gave us a lot of good drugs, but I've divested myself of those issues for quite a number of years. You should be able to understand rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis and their diagnosis, understand that they're systemic diseases, and understand some of the medications that are available for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis and how they might interact with certain drugs that you might prescribe for infections and so forth. Our first case is a 34-year-old female. She comes to your outpatient clinic. This is ambulatory medical care. With pain, stiffness, swelling in her hands for the past several months. When she wakes up in the morning, the symptoms are worse at around 7 a.m., and about 3 hours later, the stiffness resolves. So that's called morning stiffness, gelling phenomena, it's like jello. And then whenever she has prolonged inactivity throughout the day, she gets stiff all over again. So if you sit jello up on a table and it stiffens up, overnight, then you stir it, becomes liquid again. Same thing with inflammatory synovial fluid. She has a history of Hashimoto's. She smokes cigarettes, which is a risk factor for arthritis, as we will discuss. She doesn't use any drugs or alcohol. Father with psoriasis and diabetes, and a mother with RA and hypertension. Here are her labs. Rheumatoid factor is negative. An anti-CCP antibody, or ACPA, is positive, and I won't give you a titer necessarily. ANA is positive, 1 to 80 speckled. Her SED rate is elevated to 55. C-reactive protein is neither fish nor fowl, probably upper limits of normal at 4.9 milligrams per liter. She has synovitis, squishy swelling of the PIP and MCP joints. Not just bony enlargement, but actual soft tissue swelling. She has very poor fist-making ability. Otherwise, she appears to be fairly healthy. No skin rashes, no psoriasis, anything of that nature. Plain radiograph shows this. This is called juxta-articular osteopenia, which is one of the earlier findings in rheumatoid arthritis. So I'll put this out there for you. And there are other ways to evaluate early rheumatoid arthritis with diagnostic ultrasound and power Doppler, or in this case with MRI showing erosions at the lunate and at the triquetrum, positive arrow sign. What's your most likely diagnosis in this case? Anybody voting for psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis? Mother had psoriasis, or she's father, and that is a familial disease. Rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, post-viral or reactive arthritis. Well, since we are talking about rheumatoid arthritis, that's what she has. She has a chronic systemic inflammatory disease of insidious onset. Worldwide incidence is about 3 per 10,000. Prevalence is approximately 1%, most common in women in their most productive years. Women are affected 3 times more often than men. As you get older, it becomes more equal in prevalence. So here's a famous chart, this one by Jorge Munez, showing the difference between osteoarthritis distribution and rheumatoid arthritis. Where osteoarthritis is a primary degenerative process of cartilage, what we have is inflamed synovium and an autoimmune process in rheumatoid arthritis. OA affects any part of the axial skeleton, RA just the cervical spine, and spares the lumbar spine and sacroiliac joints. OA has a predilection for certain joints such as the hip, knee, great toe, first CMC joint, and of course the distribution of the PIP and DIP joints. Whereas RA is a symmetrical arthritis and can affect any joint in the body. It doesn't show the hips here, but it can affect the hips as well. Interestingly, the ankle is somehow immune to osteoarthritis, even though it's a weight-bearing joint, unless you traumatize it pretty badly. What about serologies? What's a rheumatoid factor? Well, that's a misnomer, isn't it? It was discovered in rheumatoid arthritis, so they called it a rheumatoid factor. But really all it is an immune complex. It's an IgM antibody that has an affinity for the Fc portion of IgG, the fraction crystallizable. That's the base of the Y-shaped antibody. 70% of rheumatoid arthritis patients will have a positive rheumatoid factor at diagnosis. Another 10% or so will become positive over the next couple of years. A positive rheumatoid factor without arthritis doesn't necessarily mean they have RA. Now, these immunologic changes can occur 10 years before the onset of RA. But also, we see this in hepatitis C. About 50% of patients with hep C get positive rheumatoid factors, and about the same as cryoglobulins. We see it in lupus, Sjogren's, of course. It used to be part of the diagnostic criteria. And don't forget even endocarditis. We're called the Duke minor criteria. We see rheumatoid factors, and again, almost half the patients that have endocarditis. What about the anti-citrullinated peptide, or ACPA? This is more specific, actually, than the IgM rheumatoid factor. It's seen in about 70% of patients with a 98% specificity, okay? So, it's hard to find other diseases where the ACPA is positive. And ANAs, don't let it confuse you, seen on probably at least a third of rheumatoid arthritis patients. Now, over the years, there have been classification criteria that have changed. I grew up with, believe it or not, I had the 1958 diagnostic criteria until 1987, and in 87 we had new criteria, and these are the newest classification criteria. As we go through classification criteria during the course of the morning for these various disease states, be it lupus or scleroderma or Sjogren's or whatever it is, be aware that these are for the purposes of including patients into drug studies, not necessarily for the diagnosis of the individual patient. So, this is a helpful guideline, however, to help you diagnose these patients. So we get points for joint distribution. For example, one large joint, you don't get anything. 2 to 10 large joints, you get a point. 1 to 3 small joints, you get 2 points. 4 to 10 small joints, you get 3 points. And greater than 10 joints with at least one small, you get 5 points. If you have negative rheumatoid factor in ACPA, you don't get any points. If you get low positive, that's within one-third of the upper limits of normal, you get a point. And if you get high positive, titer of either of those, that's 2 points. And finally, they do include disease duration, no points for less than 6 weeks. So you want it to be a chronic arthritis. And then acute phase reactants, you get a point if either SED rate or CRP are elevated. So greater than or equal to 6 gives you a diagnosis of RA. If it's less than 6, your patient still might fulfill the criteria over time. So you don't have to have all the criteria exactly at the same time. Same with the new criteria for lupus. You could have had thrombocytopenia 5 years ago. Now your platelets are normal, but you have an ANA, skin rash, and arthritis. So it's cumulative over time if the records are well kept on these patients. Okay, so our patient has early onset rheumatoid arthritis, all right? How do you want to treat her? What do you want to do? Because, what we've come to with rheumatoid arthritis is you use your best treatments up front, okay? You don't start with NSAIDs, you don't start with low doses of prednisone, because by the time, the best time you have to really impact the course of the disease is in the first several months of the disease activity. So anyway, this patient had poor fist-making ability. She had physical findings. She already had radiographic and erosions on MRI. Would you put her on prednisone 60 milligrams, anybody? No. I'm glad nobody raised their hand. Ibuprofen. Is ibuprofen 800 milligrams three times a day the treatment for RA? It is not. Methotrexate, well, we'll come back to that. Hydroxychloroquine, well, that's a good DMARD, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drug, and so is sulfasalazine. But in the United States, the number one DMARD is methotrexate, okay? I call that the pizza. That is our anchor drug. It's the pizza. Everything else you add to it is like, you know, pepperoni or whatever else that you put on the pizza. But that is the most number one used medication for rheumatoid arthritis in the United States, as opposed to Europe, where it's sulfasalazine. So these are the traditional disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. Most were serendipitously discovered to be effective in RA. Sulfasalazine was actually invented for RA in 1939 at the Karolinska Institute, and they combined sulfapyridine with a 5-aminosalicylic acid molecule with an azo bond. And it was a very effective medication, but 10 years later, what did they synthesize? Steroids, and they thought they had the cure for arthritis. Anyway, sulfapyridine acts as a vehicle to get aspirin into the gut for inflammatory bowel disease, so it became very popular there. And it was approved by the FDA almost 60 years later in 1997 for the treatment of RA. Methotrexate is an anti-metabolite. It's a folic acid analog, so you have to give folic acid with it. Concomitant use with trimethoprim is usually verboten, at least full dose sulfatrimethoprim, because it can cause agranulocytosis. So keep that in mind. Leflunomide is an anti-pyrimidine synthetase inhibitor, and it's fairly effective. Azathioprine is approved. It's a 6-mercaptopurine derivative, and it is approved for RA. Hydroxychloroquine, again, serendipitously discovered. Somebody took it for their malaria in the 1950s, and their arthritis went away. And it's a very important drug for the treatment of RA and also very important in lupus. It inhibits toll-like receptors on dendritic cells, families 7 and 9, and also inhibits interleukin-1. Cyclosporin A is a naturally occurring undodecapeptide, which is very effective treatment for RA, but it's cumbersome to use. It was approved probably give or take right around 1990. We also have a numerous bunch of biologics on the market. We have the anti-TNF family of medications. We have co-stimulatory inhibitors, abatacept. B-cell depletion, which is kind of novel treatment. I withhold that mostly toward the end. IL-6 inhibition, and now the new smaller molecules of tofacitinib and baricitinib, which are Janus kinase inhibitors. They seem to accomplish what the biologics, the large biologic molecules do, but are much smaller molecules. Let's go to a second case. We have a 73-year-old female with severe long-standing seropositive rheumatoid arthritis. She has both positive rheumatoid factor and positive ACPAs. She presents to the hospital for an elective cholecystectomy. She had a preoperative chest x-ray which showed multiple nodules, which have been unchanged for years from prior x-rays, and she also has multiple rheumatoid nodules and rheumatoid deformities. So rheumatoid nodules in the lungs may be also called necrobiotic nodules, and they are associated with positive rheumatoid factor. So you don't get nodules usually without rheumatoid factor. She's got skin nodules. So under the old criteria, we'd call this classical RA because she's got nodulosis and positive rheumatoid factor. Surgery goes well. No immediate surgical complications, but in the recovery, she cannot wean off the ventilator, she cannot initiate breaths, and she cannot move her extremities. Which of these tests should have been performed preoperatively? Who votes for a CAR cath? Who votes for MRI of the brain? Who votes for an A1C? How about radiographs of the cervical spine with flexion and extension views? Okay. That's kind of part of, this is why I want you to start thinking of these diseases, because that's kind of a normal part of the preoperative evaluation of anybody with longstanding RA. One of the major complications of rheumatoid arthritis, particularly, is atlantoaxial subluxation. And here you can see, let's see, I'll try to use these pointers. Right there, you'll see that the odontoid is separating from the, I'm going to go to this side as well, from the, this is the anterior arch of C1, this is the odontoid. So in forward flexion, she's actually getting an upper motor neuron lesion as the odontoid process impinges upon the upper spinal cord. So when you see these patients in your office, if they have neck pain, what you're going to see is an upper motor neuron lesion. Upgoing toes, hyper-reflexibility, these types of features, okay? So bear that in mind if you see them. Typically, we don't operate them unless they have long track signs such as urinary or bladder or bowel incontinence. So RA is a systemic disease. I want you to keep that in mind. Some of the, besides skin, some of the major involvement is the lungs, where we can see rheumatoid nodules. These can cavitate and they can rupture and cause empyema. Also, we can get interstitial lung disease, okay, pulmonary fibrosis, tends to be bibasilar, and we can get pleurisy with or without effusions. And what are the typical board questions? Was they're giving you the composition of a pleural effusion in someone with RA is exquisitely low glucose levels, typically less than 10. So that's one of the features of that. In cardiac-wise, patients have a much higher incidence of myocardial infarction, cardiovascular disease. So, right, cardiovascular disease, we know more and more about. It's not just a matter of your cholesterol being elevated. It's about inflammation. It's about having, you know, rough endothelium of the blood vessels. And these patients all have a little bit of vasculitis, so it's good places for plaques to occur. And actually, hazard ratio for MIs decrease in patients who are taking drugs like methotrexate. And they can get an exudative or what we call bread and butter pericarditis as well. Okay. Third case. This is a 72-year-old retired mechanic. He presents to your office with worsening bilateral hand pain. The pain is most pronounced at the PIP joints and DIP joints of both his hands and the basal joints of the thumbs. He has about 5 minutes of pain in the morning and stiffness, and then, you know, he seems to do okay. Then with prolonged activity, it gets worse again. He's had prior joint replacements of large joints. Okay. What do we see here? So interestingly, we see involvement of the PIP joints and the DIP joints. But look at the MCP joints. I mean, they are completely spared. Now, if you ask me why that occurs, I don't know. And notice the difference between this and the periarticular osteopenia we saw in someone with RA. What you see here is irregular joint space narrowing and marked bony reparative change. So this is nodal osteoarthritis. Being a mechanic may have predisposed him to it, but very often this is an inherited form of arthritis, typically from mothers to daughters, where you see this type of bony hypertrophy. So at the PIP joints, these are called Bouchard's nodes, and at the DIP joints, they're called Heberden's nodes. So most likely diagnosis here is osteoarthritis. There are radiographic features that would distinguish RA, hemochromatosis. You would see quite a bit of different appearance, maybe chondrocalcinosis and bone hooks at the MCP joints, Wilson's and gouty arthropathy. Again, quite different appearance radiographically. Osteoarthritis is the most common joint disease, affecting more than 30 million individuals in the United States. 80 to 90% of adults over 65 have radiographic evidence of osteoarthritis. And radiographic features include joint space narrowing and then the findings of bony reparative change, osteophytosis, subchondrosclerosis, and subchondral cyst-like change. There are various risk factors that contribute to osteoarthritis. As in our patient, mechanical injury was a factor. For example, we used to have a thing called jackhammer arthropathy, where people would get osteoarthritis of the shoulders. Obesity, of course, on the weight-bearing joints, but also there are just endocrine changes that occur in obesity that affects the cartilage health. Inflammatory meteors, advancing age, overuse, genetics. Honestly, some people, their cartilages are programmed to last about 30, 35 years, and then they start to wear out. And then race and sex can have just like a genetic bearing. So nodal osteoarthritis is more common amongst women, et cetera. The non-pharmacologic treatment is reducing strain and stress on joints, physical therapy, and splinting. An occupational therapist can help a lot with the hand osteoarthritis, ice or heat. Pharmacologic therapy, NSAIDs, either topical or oral, acetaminophen, and judicious use of intra-articular steroids. And surgical would be total joint arthroplasty or arthrodesis, which is fusion, when necessary.